Good morning. As we were reading Psalm 89, you probably ran across a few verses there that are very familiar to you. One of those groups of verses was one we just sang. Blessed are the people that know the joyful sound. They shall walk, O Lord, in the light of thy countenance, and in thy name shall they rejoice all the day, and in thy righteousness shall they be exalted. Now, when you read those words, or when you sing those words, what is it that you think about? There are a number of very profitable thoughts, I'm sure, that come out of those words, but what comes to your mind? Well, looking through the readings and looking to today, I was reading the New International Version, and those very familiar words weren't quite so familiar to me in the NIV, even though I read it most of the time. They weren't perhaps quite as poetic, but they were certainly had a slightly different light on them that I found very useful to me. They read this way: Blessed are those that have learned to acclaim you, who walk in the light of your presence, O Lord. They rejoice in your name all the day long. They exalt in your righteousness. And the little phrase that caught my mind and took it somewhere, because I was also looking at the Old Testament readings at that time as well, is the phrase, blessed or happy are those who have learned to acclaim you. In other words, that's the phrase, people that know the joyful sound in the King James. Well, what's the point? Well, the point is that the focus is just a little bit different. The focus is, as at least it was to me, that when we are praising God is something that is learned. It is not just something that rolls off the lips. It is something that is learned. It is something that is understood to the point that we are able to be joyful about doing this, about making that sound. That know the joyful sound. And that's the word know that was accentuated to me when I read the NIV, and it says praising God basically is learned. So where are we going to take this? Well, we take it back somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 years to the readings that we've been reading all through the week in Exodus. And you don't have to turn there, because I'm sure you'll remember a lot of the things that we were reading there. Well, what was in those readings that we've been looking at? Well, one thing that is very clear in those readings is that our God is very particular. He's very precise, and he commands respect. We read about where God gave Moses his definition of what justice was, what mercy was. He taught him about Sabbath laws that the people were to observe. He reemphasized that very particular place where his people would go, the place that he had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob. And he said, it won't just happen. I'm putting an angel to go before you. I'm going to make it happen for you, to guard them, to bring you there. And then he talked about worship, and he said, specifically, the elders are to come so far to worship me and no further. But you, Moses, you're to come closer to me. He was drawing Moses out as a very special man, the man that he became before God. There was an order to this worship. And as we read through details upon details, there were very specific instructions. Instructions about offerings and how they were to be offered, and about the items involved in that worship, about a table and a lampstand and an ark, but not just any lampstand or table or ark. They all had a particular pattern that he gave Moses on the mount. And it talks about the clothes that the priests were supposed to wear. There was an order to that as well. And the very consecration of the priests. And then in the first of today's readings in Exodus, we have these two gentlemen, Bezalel and Aholiab, brought to light. And those are two men that are pulled out of here, and we hardly ever hear about them again. And why do those two names come out? They came out because they served a very specific purpose of God. They had specific skills that God had given these two men so that they could make the things that God told them to make. And the actual words are from God, they are to make them just as I commanded you. This isn't to allow artistic flair or interpretation. They're to be just as I commanded you. The pattern that he saw on the mount, as it has said elsewhere. So it's a lot of specifics. And one of the things that the people were supposed to take from all these various commands, all this order that God was putting before them, was that their God was different. He was the only God. He was to be respected. He was to be served as the only God, and to be served as if each one of them respected him. That he was holy. That he was a mighty God. And the way they showed it and demonstrated it was by listening to what he asked of them, to these very specific things, and not to modify them, but to do as he had asked. And it showed that they respected him when they obeyed him. And it's the word that our brother Fred happened to pull out of Psalm 89 when he introduced, really, when he had his opening comments. It was the word reverence that he pulled out of there. It's what reverence is built on. And I'm sure, as we all understand, nothing has changed. He's the same God. He's the same God who requires from us the same respect. That we don't modify the things that he's set for us to do and to say and to think and the person that we are supposed to become before him. So the question is, when all these people that, as the comment was made, knew not God when they were in Egypt, they had to be taught in the desert, when they were given all these instructions, what did they do with them? And who did they see? Who did they see? For instance, when they stood, probably frozen, at the side of the Red Sea, or the west side of the Red Sea, and they saw behind them a massive Egyptian army coming to take them out. The best possible scenario was they'd take them back to Egypt, but the worst scenario was a lot of them would die. King James says they had great fear. NIV says they were terrified. What did they do when they were terrified? Well, the actual words in Exodus 14 say, they cried out to the Lord and said to Moses. They cried out to God and said to Moses. And what does Moses do? Because they were looking to him. Moses is very specific in what he does. He refocuses their attention away from himself and back to where the power really was, to God. And he says in verse 13, stand firm and you will see. What are you going to see? The deliverance the Lord will bring today. And it's interesting how he relates it to them. He says, the Egyptians that you see today, that power that scares you, you will never see again. They will be removed. They will be gone. The Lord will fight for you. Those were the words he used. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. And what was the summary of that event? Well, the summary comes in verse 31 of that chapter 14. It says, and when the Israelites saw the great power of the Lord that he displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant. And we might say, yes, well, seeing is believing. Well, that would be pretty impressive if that was you there and you thought your life could be taken away any minute. And the Lord God Almighty responded in an unprecedented way that had never been seen before. The Red Sea parting and going across on dry ground. Moving that forward a little into today's readings. In Exodus 32 that we had read this morning, what was it the people saw then? What do you think they understood? Well, in today's reading, it's a little bit different, isn't it? In today's reading, it says in verse 1, when the people saw that Moses... So they're looking to Moses. When the people saw that Moses was long in coming down, they saw Moses, but they had difficulty seeing God. The understanding that God was there in the parting of the Red Sea, in the plagues, in the miracles, in the desert, that it was he that brought them out of Egypt, had temporarily waned or had gone the other way. We know what they did. As you continue on in verse 1 and into verse 2 of chapter 32, it says, as for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, well, who brought them up out of Egypt? Was that a little slip of the tongue? As for Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, it probably wasn't a slip of the tongue. It was probably reflective of what they really thought. It was more like the truth to them. And the reason we know that is because what follows immediately after this. The point is, they saw their leader, Moses, was absent, and instead of turning to God, they said, we'll fix this. We'll do this ourselves. And they provided their own way. They did not see the God that Moses saw. They saw something else. They did not understand that God was holy the way that God wanted them to understand it, at least not at this particular point. They didn't see the powerful God who could do anything. And they certainly didn't see him as their Savior because they wanted a God made for them that they could see. So what did God say to Moses about this when Moses was on the mount? Because that's when this was happening, obviously, wasn't it? He said to Moses, I'm going to destroy this people, and I'm going to build my nation through you. Now, here's another place where we see who Moses was. What is it that motivated Moses? What did Moses see? What did he understand about the God that he served? Well, what would be the logical response to that when God says, this is what I'm going to do, Moses. I'm going to wipe these people out. I'm going to start over again through you. Well, one logical response to that would be, you are the Almighty God. You are always right. You know what you're doing. Who am I to speak? And here's the man who at the burning bush, and just after the burning bush, says, I can't speak, Lord. You know that I'm not good at speaking, and God was really angry with him, but he gave him Aaron. This Moses has changed a little bit, but he could have thought, well, who am I to speak? I've learned my lesson. Go ahead, make a new nation through me, essentially. But that wasn't his response. He didn't use that response at all. It was quite different. He, as it says, sought God's favor. He pleaded for this people because he wanted to deal with them again the way he had had trouble with them before. They're nothing but difficulty for him, nothing but grief. Was that why? Was he nationalistic? Did he take a certain pride in this group of people that he had brought out, that he had led out by God's power? Well, we know what it was. He had two reasons for approaching God and pleading for this people. He said, because your name will be discredited by such as the Egyptians. They'll say, you took this group of people of yours out into the wilderness and then you slaughtered them. What point is that? How great is that? He says that you'll be discredited before the people, and because of your promises, the promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So what was Moses doing? He was putting God's holiness first. And Moses understood that far more than the people understood that. They wanted a God to take over from Moses. Funny enough, not from God, but from Moses, because they didn't know where Moses had gone to. So the role that Moses takes here is quite noteworthy, isn't it? The role that he took is one of mediation. And so after God said, okay, I will relent from that, Moses goes down the mountain, and what does he find when he gets to the bottom? Well, we know. This nation was absolutely out of control, and he saw this, and I can just begin to imagine what he must have thought, how he had pleaded for the lives of all these people, and then look what they have done. Look what they were displaying. Look how they were serving this God who had so mercifully forgiven these people and allowed them to live. And Moses knew that this was a very serious situation. And even though he pleaded for their lives, he did something. He acted. He said, whoever's on the Lord's side, come to me and strap on a sword. And 3,000 people, we are told, died that day at the instruction of Moses. Now, that's a far sight different from all of them being wiped out, probably in the neighborhood of 2 million people. 3,000 is a very, very, very small percentage of that. But what it said was, this is very, very serious. We get this right or we don't go on. And he dealt with it right there. And then what did Moses do? He wasn't vindictive. What did he do? He pleaded for the people again. He interceded for them again. And he said to the people, look, in verse 30 of that chapter, you have committed a great sin, but now I will go up to the Lord. It's not going to be him that's forgiving. I will go up to the Lord and perhaps I can make atonement for your sin, which he does in praying to God. And then, remembering the man Moses was, he even said, please forgive their sin, but if not, then blot me out from the book you have written. And without going into that, God's reply is, whoever has sinned against me, that's the person I will blot out of my book. Now you go and lead, Moses, essentially. You lead this people. But what an understanding of God Moses had to have that approach. And through this period of time, during the Exodus, it's one of the clear messages that we see in Exodus, and it's the message of that Psalm 89. Blessed are the people who have learned to acclaim you. And when they've learned to acclaim you, they walk in your presence, O Lord, in the light of your presence. They rejoice in your day, they rejoice in your name all the day long. They exalt in your righteousness. And that's what Moses was representing here. But it's not hard to lose focus from that, is it, when we think about that personally? It's not hard at all. We have visible security. The people had Moses. They looked to him. When they had a problem, they went to him. And when that's taken away, sometimes that can rattle us. But we learn to acclaim our God, to put him into our life, to treat him with reverence. Because it's our pleasure, because of who he is. And it's part of our own personal faith being matured. I think it's perhaps what's left when our lives have taken a bit of a thumping. Whatever that situation might be, it's that little bit that takes us back to this God who is everything to us. Where all the power is, where all the might, the forgiveness, the loving kindness, it's that acknowledgement of God in our lives. And sometimes it takes those kind of events to bring us back to him, that he is a holy God, that he is a unique God. And it's why we read things about God. We listen to things. We discuss things. We teach things, not just to our children. We help each other with them. And it's about details. It's about the kind of details we read in Exodus. Where does that bring us? Well, it's those details that do things in our lives, like it's why we're here this morning and not at another church down the road. It's details. And it isn't those details that of themselves save us. We know that. But it's understanding them and obeying them that shows our reverence, and it helps grow that faith that we are trying to develop, that faith that is so important to us throughout our lives. It's that type of appreciation that brings us to rejoice in his name and to exalt in his righteousness. And there's sometimes in our lives when situation is completely out of our hands, just like when the children of Israel stood on the west bank of the Red Sea with the Egyptian army behind them. They had no control over that. There's times in our lives when we don't have any control over that. And it's times when, as the saying is often used, when we have to just let go and let God. And that of itself sometimes is not easy to do, is it? But there's other times in our lives when we're in a position where we need to do something. We have to make a decision. Or we have to remove ourselves from a situation, or whatever it is, we are faced with having to make a decision. Similar to perhaps what Hezekiah had to face in 2 Chronicles 32, when we were told that after all Hezekiah had so faithfully done, and that's an interesting introduction, after all he had so faithfully done, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and invaded Judah. If we want to put it bluntly, as people would understand it, bad things happen to good people. It's part of what helps us grow. He had been very, very faithful, and here's this nation invading him. And Hezekiah knew that if he started invading throughout Judah, he would eventually come to him in Jerusalem and want the whole country. And he had seen it just happen a little earlier with Israel. And so what did he do about it? He did what was in his power to do. He had to do something. The people were looking to him. What was he going to do? He did what was in his power, and both he and Isaiah cried out in prayer to God, and the prayer of Hezekiah is recorded for us. And I just want to go to the very last words of that prayer. He says, "Now, O Lord our God, deliver us from his hand so that," what? "So that we can be saved and live in peace. So that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you alone are Lord, that you are God." And that's virtually the same as the plea that Moses made that we considered just a little earlier. Both Hezekiah and Moses chose to put God's glory first, despite the fact that in both cases it was a life and death situation. And that's something for us to keep in mind too, isn't it? Was this just in Hezekiah's private prayer? Is this just where we saw it? Well, it isn't, and that's why I raise it. What did he do? Well, he fortified the city. He made weapons. He diverted the water source from outside the city to the inside the city, so that the people would have water if it was a long siege, if that was God's answer, that it wasn't an immediate salvation. He didn't know what God's answer was going to be. He did what he could do, and then he left the rest to God. And what's interesting is what he says to his commanders and to the people. He goes out to them and he says, "Be strong and courageous, do not be afraid." Well, why shouldn't you be afraid? Well, because I fortified the city. I made all these weapons. Can't you see how secure we are here? We can hold up for a long time. But that wasn't Hezekiah. That's not what he said to them, is it? He said to them, "For there is a greater power with us than with him. For with him is the arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord our God to help fight our battles." That's what we read in Exodus. fight our battles. And the people, it says, gained confidence from what Hezekiah, the king of Judah, said. It was something that was very real to Hezekiah at that time. And he approached God in that way when he thought, when you looked around, he was going to be taken. He knew that God was the stronger power, and that's the only place he could put his reliance. King Saul, a number of years earlier, ran against the same problem. At that time, it was the Philistines. And he knew he was outnumbered greatly. He knew that if nothing changed, he was going to lose. Israel was going to lose. And that worried him. And he cried out to God in prayer. And God wouldn't listen to him. Because Saul hadn't his life in order. He did not understand who God was. Hezekiah understood who God was. God heard Hezekiah and saved him and the people. He didn't hear Saul. Saul was killed, and so was Jonathan. And Israel was scattered on the hills. There's a huge, huge difference. You see, these things become very personal to every one of us. Because the challenge for each of us is to learn who God is to us personally, not academically. It's not the answer that we might give if we were being interviewed for baptism, for instance, which is rather topical this morning, I'm happy to say. As right as those answers may be that are given, it has to progress to more than that. It has to mature in our lives so that we value, we reverence, and we love our God. That we obey Him because we love Him. That we pay attention to the specifics of God's way and not a modified way that we have chosen. It becomes very important. And it brings us into the realm of being able to acclaim Him, to acknowledge Him in our lives and allow that to shape us. Because we believe that it was God who separated the Red Sea, that happened. We believe that it was God who sent the plagues on Egypt, that it was God who provided food in a wasteland for so many people. We believe it was God who worked with Moses to lead those people, and we believe it's the same God who works with you and with me in our lives now. He's just as powerful, just as effective, and just as real. When Hezekiah saw that army before him, it was very, very real. It wasn't theoretical to Hezekiah. It was real. And it's not theoretical to us. Because with us is the Lord to help us fight our battles, whatever those may be, whatever form they take in our lives. And sometimes it makes us question ourselves as to where just how strong our faith might be. And sometimes we probably rise to the occasion, just like Hezekiah did, just like Moses did. And we put God first before self, and we see it through a right perspective. And there are other times when we fall flat on our face. But it's where we go after that happens. It's where we come back to and what we cling to. It's who we put first and where we go on from there. So we look to God despite our weaknesses, no matter what they may be. And we begin to feel the power of the words, "Blessed are the people who know the joyful sound. They shall walk, O Lord, in the light of thy countenance, and in thy name shall they rejoice all the day, and in thy righteousness shall they be exalted." We begin to understand that when we come to know God better, when we are growing ourselves. And now we focus on the emblems that are on this table before us. The emblems that speak to us of a loving kindness, of a mercy, of forgiveness, and of a hope so great and so powerful, It gives us reason to live in our lives so that we may learn to acclaim our God above all else.